thing we knew that song, wasn't it? What a week, huh? I spent the first part of this week, and met with the elders Wednesday night and told them that I had spent the first part of this week on the internet trying to pull together some things for an introduction to try to demonstrate the state of affairs in this country. And I told him I felt like I'd wasted the entire first part of my week because I decided to let this week speak for itself for my introduction. We're in a series of lessons on moral issues of our day. And the media headlines this week regarding the decision by the Boy Scouts to reaffirm their policy of not accepting homosexuals, and the radio interview of the president and chief operating officer of Chick-fil-A franchise and his comments about his company being started in 1948, I believe, by his father, and the determination for it to be a family-centered, biblical-centered company. And then he made a statement something to the effect of, how dare we as Americans have the audacity to think that we had the right to redefine God's definition of marriage? And the headlines that came from those incidences, Boy Scouts contribute to violence against gays. Chick-fil-A president slams gay marriage. And then, to top things off, the incident that happened in Aurora, Colorado, the incredible, senseless violence that took place there. I guess I'll just say that that's my introduction for us to contemplate our country and where we are and how even those people who are the one people who are trying to assure that this country is a moral country become the villains in this country. And we must talk about these things. To be real honest with you, part of me wants to go and find a place to crawl in a hole somewhere and get in a fishing boat and get out on the water and get away from everything and everybody. And it's not bad to do that sometimes, but all of you have heard the quote that is attributed to Edmund Burke, who was an 18th century Irish philosopher. All that is necessary for the triumph of evil is that good men do nothing. And we all think, what can we do about this? What's our role? The story is told of an old lady who had moved to the United States from Europe when she was a child, but now she wanted to officially become a citizen of this country. And after months of going through and studying and going through all the necessary red tape, she was finally ready to take the required oath of allegiance. Raise your right hand, please. She raised her right hand. The first question. Do you swear to defend the Constitution of the United States against all its enemies, foreign and domestic? The little lady's face paled and her voice trembled, and she asked in a small voice, all by myself? I know the feeling, don't you? When I hear the news and I read what the Apostle Paul had to say about this great spiritual battle that's going on, I tremble. Paul said, we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this age, against spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places. Ephesians chapter 6, verse 12. And in Job's complaining against God, he said, when he passes by me, I cannot see him. When he goes by, I cannot perceive him. Job 9:11. It's hard to confront what you cannot see, isn't it? And then on the other hand, it's rather hard to trust what you cannot see also, isn't it? The thoughts of waging such a battle alone is enough to cause even the most stout-hearted among us to tremble. But the good news is that we don't go into this battle alone. We go forth as part of God's army, led by His Son in all of His glory, and side by side with every brother and sister in Christ on the face of this earth. The battle is still a difficult one. There will be many casualties along the way because the enemy doesn't fight by the same rules. But thank God, we don't fight it alone. And there are some things that we can do. And I promised you last week that we'd talk about this, and I don't know what you expected of it. But the things that we can do not necessarily assure that we're going to gain the victory as far as this country is concerned. They do guarantee that we'll gain the victory personally for eternity. And so I'm going to suggest to you some things that we as Christians can do in the midst of this dark world in which we live. First of all, we need to set our mind to fully realize and know that we can serve God faithfully under any and every circumstance. Regardless of what our circumstances are, we can serve God faithfully. And it's important that we know that. My brothers and sisters in the first century lived under conditions that were worse than the conditions that we live under. Let me give you an illustration. Recall what you know about Nero. He came to power at age 17. That would put him chronologically in the Bible just after Acts chapter 15, the Jerusalem conference. To keep him from interfering with the state affairs, those in power encouraged him to indulge his sensuality with no restraint. They just wanted to marginalize him, keep him out of the way so he wouldn't interfere. And so, as a young man, as a teenage boy, emperor, he threw extravagant parties costing up to what would be the equivalent of $600,000 per party in our modern language and terms. And he and his friends liked to disguise themselves as common street thugs. They became what we would call today a street gang. And they visited brothels, and they robbed shops. They insulted women publicly. They beat young boys on the street. And one senator who defended himself was forced to open his veins and kill himself. Now, this is the leader of the country, the emperor. He fell in lust with a senator's wife, and he had that senator commissioned to foreign service, and he married his wife while he was gone. And when his mother objected, he had her murdered. And viewing his mother's unclothed, bloody body, he remarked, "I didn't know I had so beautiful a mother." And when people protested his divorce and remarriage, he had his first wife murdered. At 25, he had himself declared deity. He became a god. And he built his golden house, adorned with a 120-foot high image of his head, haloed with solar rays. At 27, on July the 18th, 64 A.D., Rome burned. And fully two-thirds of the city was destroyed. And as the citizens wandered the streets, crazed with anger, looking for someone to blame, then Nero found a scapegoat in the Christians. And in a now famous description of his actions, the historian Tacitus writes, "They, Christians, were put to death with exquisite cruelty. And to their sufferings, Nero added mockery and derision. Some were covered with skins of wild beasts and left to be devoured by dogs. Others were nailed to crosses. Numbers of them were burned alive. Many covered with flammable matter were set on fire to serve as torches during the day. The next year, he became violently angry with his now expectant wife and kicked her in the stomach so hard that she died. And then he grieved publicly over the loss of a prospective heir. He soon met a young man who reminded him of his wife, and so he had him castrated and married him in a formal wedding ceremony. And then he had his wedding night in an open lit barge for all of Rome to watch. It was this Nero to whom Paul appealed as Caesar. That's the backdrop for which the New Testament was written. That's the circumstances that our early brothers and sisters lived in and the government under which they lived. And so we know this. We know that our society cannot become so evil and so bad that it's impossible for us to serve God faithfully or to faithfully proclaim the gospel. And I've told my children since their early life, prepare yourself for the worst and work the best. So we must prepare our minds to serve God regardless of the cost. And the cost could become severe. But we must prepare ourselves now because it'll be too late if we wait to make decisions, if difficulty comes into our life personally because of being a Christian. And I could have said this 15 years ago, and it wouldn't have struck home nearly so seriously, would it? Because we wouldn't have dreamed 15 or 20 years ago of things happening such as happened here that we've just described in early Rome. Secondly, some things that we as Christians can do, we can encourage the passage of moral laws and work to defeat immoral laws. When I was living in Arkansas, because of some letters that I wrote to my senator, he called me and asked me if I'd be willing to meet with him and some members of the governor's staff at the Capitol to discuss a particular amendment that was on the table. It was a gambling amendment. And so I would say to you, don't become so cynical that you think that at least some of your elected officials won't listen when you contact them. And when you contact them courteously and reasonably with what you say, if you're just venting your anger and dumping some venom on them, then you're not helping anything. And then I would say to you that we also can find peaceful ways to express your convictions. There's a couple of things that are very significant as citizens of this country. One is how you spend your money, and the other is how you vote. Those two things are things that you can use. And I would say regarding voting, don't vote as a Republican. And don't vote as a Democrat. Vote as a Christian. Let me say it again. I want to hear a few more amens. Don't vote as a Democrat. Don't vote as a Republican. Vote as a Christian. Thank you. I mean that seriously. We become part of the problem if we just vote a ticket. Now, I just made some enemies probably. So be it. I'm saying to you, in everything that we do it as a Christian. We're a citizen of this country as a Christian. And our priority is a Christian before it is a member of a part of this country, an American. We're a Christian first and an American second, or somewhere else down the line. And so I'm not trying to tell you how to vote, except I am saying that as Christians, we have a responsibility to vote as a Christian. And I also want to say that we all struggle with how much to be involved in politics. And I can't tell you that. It's not my job to tell you how much to be involved in it. There is generally a danger on both ends of it. But I would say this to you, that God sent some prophets to preach to the common folks, and God sent some prophets to preach to kings. And it was probably pretty easy for those prophets who were sent to preach to the common folk to criticize those that were sent to preach to kings and vice versa. The gospel's for everybody. And then I want to also add right here in this context to be really truthful in what you communicate in social media. And if it is your practice to just hit send it on forward, then you need to stop. You need to know what you're sending. People need to be able to trust that what you send to them is true. And just to put at the front of it, I don't know if this is true or not, but I'm sending this, is to fall exactly in the category of what we talked about that Hitler's officer Goebbels said. We don't speak to say something. We speak for an effect. And if you send things along to other people just for an effect, how is that any different? If you don't know if it's true, and you send things along that are not true, then you marginalize yourself so that people won't listen to you. And so let's hold truth in really, really high regard. That was one of our lessons in this series. One was on tolerance, one was on our value of truth. Now we're talking about what we can do about this. Let's hold truth in really, really high regard. So that when someone hears something from us, they can know that's the truth. And then another thing that we can do as Christians is we can quit laughing and being entertained by sin. We receive humorous anecdotes by email each week, and sometimes those are not things that are really things that a Christian should be laughing at. We hear jokes someone tells, and we feel an obligation to laugh. Let's have the courage to not laugh. Because you see, if you can laugh at it, you can live with it. And to flip that coin over, the dark side of that is, if you do laugh at it, then you'll never be able to effectively take a stand against it. And so when you laugh at sin, and you laugh at a joke about whatever it might be, adultery or fornication or homosexuality or whatever it may be, when you laugh at that, those people who heard you laugh, you'll never be able to take an effective stand against that from then on. Because they'll remember the fact that you laughed at it. Because laughter, at least to some degree, indicates your approval of it, your acceptance of it. Be not conformed to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Then, and only then, that's my little addition. Then, and only then, when you're not conformed to the pattern of this world, but you're transformed, you will be able to test and approve what God's will is. Only when you are not conformed to this world's pattern will you be able to effectively differentiate between what God's will is and what God's will is not. You know why? Because otherwise all cats become gray. Everything is thrown in the middle. And then you can make it be whatever you want it to. And then, fourthly, be bold, but be compassionate. Don't come across as someone who is bitter and angry and hostile. You don't affect people positively when that's your attitude. And remember, you can love someone without approving of their actions. And we really do, in our opposition to sin in this world, we really need to come across as being people who love people and who are compassionate. And if we condemn someone's action, we need to come across as someone who loves that person as a person. But we may despise their actions. My children need to hear, and my grandchildren need to hear and see someone stand up and say, this is wrong. And you know, of all the things that come out of this whole series of lessons, that's the thing that I keep getting feedback from you. Appreciation of someone who stands up and says what we all know, but what so many have become afraid to say. This is wrong. This is sin. You know, I had someone like that in my life that served as an example of someone who wasn't afraid to stand up, and that was my dad. And I've shared with you some of the things about my early life when we were first starting a church, before the church ever existed, in a certain town in Louisiana. And my dad and myself and two or three other men were clearing off a lot and putting up a tent. We used to do that, you know, have gospel meetings in a tent in a community. Putting up a tent, and word got out that the Church of Christ was going to begin meeting on this lot. We had purchased this lot in town, and so while we're in the process of erecting that tent, the city police came. And I was just a little kid, and I can still remember the police car pulling up out there and them getting out, two of them getting out and coming to talk to my dad, and I didn't know what it was about, so I got close enough that I could hear, and I heard what they said to him. They said, you can't put that tent up here in this town because it's against the fire code. Well, in fact, it wasn't, okay? But they didn't want it to be put up. There were some people in town who didn't want it to be put up. And so they told my dad, they said, if you put this tent up, then we're going to have to come and arrest you. And I can still see him and hear him. Because it scared me and filled me with pride at the same time. He said, if you want to come back here at 7 o'clock tonight, then you can arrest me because I'll be preaching under this tent at 7 o'clock tonight. Now, that burned in the kid's brain. Whenever my family, as a boy, we went out and knocked doors in the community and set up Bible studies, one of the places that we went that many other white churches wouldn't go is we went across into the black community. We knocked doors, set up Bible study, baptized the first black lady. When that happened, there was a cross. The Ku Klux Klan burned a cross in front of our house. That scared a young boy too. And there was a family, the first time that this black lady came to church, there was a family in the church, longtime members, that the man stood up and said, if they're coming here, my family is not coming here, in front of the whole church. And my dad stood up and he said, we'll miss you. Now, that had a real impact on my life, obviously, because I had someone as a role model that stood up against, in that case, the authorities, whatever those authorities may be. And so we need to be bold, but we need to be compassionate. And we need fathers, particularly, and mothers, to accept the responsibility for protecting your family. God gave you those children as a stewardship, and He expects you to teach them and train them in His way. And you need to be aware of what they spend their time doing. And you need to be aware of what they see on the computer. And you need to set rules for them that they can't set for themselves. You're the adult and you're the parent. And they don't run your home, you do. Right? Set your children down and talk to them and listen to what they have to say. And ask them about their life and what's happening at school and take the time. Your your children, your community need to hear someone stand up and say, this is wrong. And live that way. Some few years ago, I wrote a series of articles that was entitled, exactly the title of these lessons, Moral Issues of Our Day. There were about 12 articles, and the elders had asked me to write these, and I had written a number of things for the newspaper before. And so when I went down to the religious editor, whom I knew, and sat down with him with the first one and said, we're going to run this series of about 12 articles. And he said, well, we'll run them for free. And I said, no, we don't want you to run them for free. He said, what do you mean? I said, they're written exactly the way that I want them to be written. And if you run it for free, then you have the right of editorship. And I don't want you to have that right. I want you to run it exactly as they are, and so we'll pay for it. Well, he argued with it. He said, well, why would you want to spend that money? I said, because of just what I said. We want it run exactly the way that it's written. That series of articles really took a life of its own, and over the period of the next few months, we made it, because there were so many requests for all of those to be put together, we made it into a booklet, and over 5,000 requests came in from every source. In fact, several newspapers from around the United States, from one coast to the other, called and asked if they could have permission to run those in their newspapers. Several denominational churches called and asked if they could use that as their Bible class material for their Bible classes. And of course, I was happy for them to do so. People need to see and hear someone stand up and say what we all know, but that so many have become afraid to say. Don't be just satisfied either with telling people what's wrong. You tell them that Jesus loves them and he has the answer to the problems in their life, and don't be intimidated into silence. Don't be intimidated into silence on your job or wherever it is. Take a stand. Put on the whole armor of God, and then having done all to stand, stand, therefore. Stand. And then, last of all, I would say, don't preach a watered-down gospel, and don't allow a watered-down gospel to be preached or taught. It's not our job. God didn't say to us, stop what's happening in your country. Now, we would like to change some things, set things on a different course. We want to do that. We try to do that. But he didn't tell us that that's what we are to, that we have to accomplish that in order to please him. And we wonder why folks are not interested in hearing the gospel. Well, at least part of the answer to that is because people won't take medicine for something that they don't feel like they need. And if we don't know we're lost, then somebody telling us how to be saved is of no value to us. It's just a waste of time. Because we've preached a God of love to the exclusion of a God of righteousness, then we have a nation and sometimes a group of religious people who don't want to hear what God has to say, because our life is the way we want it to be. And I know it's not popular. And we say, God will never do anything to hurt you. Well, you tell Nadab and Abihu and Sodom and Gomorrah and the people treading water in the flood and Uzzah and the Baal prophets on Mount Carmel and in the New Testament, you tell Ananias and Sapphira that. We must determine whether what our responsibility is, what our job is. We need to be clear about what our mission is and determine whose approval it is we want. We need to determine if our job is to build a big church or preach the message to a lost world. And we need to be really clear about that, because there's a difference. And God knew that most folks wouldn't listen. He sent Jeremiah. When he commissioned him, he told him, they're not going to listen to you. I've made you like a fenced city, an iron pillar, a brass wall. You speak exactly what I tell you to kings, princes, priests, and people. Do not be afraid, And if you're afraid in front of them, I'll abandon you in front of them. They'll continually fight against you, but they won't prevail, for I'm with you to deliver you, says the Lord. Don't get discouraged. Don't get discouraged. Elijah got to the point where he said, I'm the only one left. And God corrected him, didn't he? He said, there are thousands of people that you don't know about who haven't bowed the knee to Baal. Don't get discouraged. It's really easy to do so. God wants his pure message preached to circle the globe. And that gospel will, and you've heard me say this before, but it's one of my favorite illustrations. That gospel, like a magnet, will pull out every person from every nation who will hear. And that defines our mission. We're to pass that magnet over the whole world. And he who has ears will hear. And we're not alone. We may or may not be able to save our society. Noah wasn't. He was the only preacher of righteousness. But it's like the little illustration of the boy and his dad who rounded the corner to catch the bus. And as they rounded the corner about two blocks away, they saw the bus pulling away from the curb. And the dad grabbed the little boy's hand and he said, let's run, son. And he started, grabbed his hand and started running. The little boy looked up and he said, Dad, we're going to miss it. There's no way. They're already pulling away. He said, I know, son, we probably will, but let's miss it running. And I have to tell you, I like that. Let's miss it running. I don't know what's going to happen. God knows. God's in control. God, I'm on God's side. And so I'm not alone. And I'll leave you with this word of encouragement and admonition. This is Peter's conclusion to his sermon on Pentecost. God's promise is for you and all the children that are far off, as many as the Lord our God will call. And with many other words, he warned them and he pleaded with them, save yourselves from this crooked generation. It was that way in his time. It's that way in our time. We've been incredibly blessed in this country, haven't we, to have the freedoms and blessings and privileges that we have. Let's not get to the point that we think we have to have those things in order to serve God. In the New Testament, when difficulty came and persecution came, Rome, the most powerful nation that had ever existed to that time by far, took its heavy hand and it hit as hard as it could on top of the Christians to wipe them out. And what it did is it splattered them all over the world. So be it. I just certainly don't want persecution and difficulty to come. I love what God has blessed us with in this country. But we can be Christians. We can be faithful Christians. We can take the gospel to the world. We can proclaim the good news to a lost and dying world. Regardless of what our environment is. Let's never, ever, ever forget that. And let's be harmless as doves and wise as serpents in the midst of all of this difficulty. I want to go to heaven. Don't you? I want my children to go and my grandchildren to go to heaven. And I may not be able to save the whole world, but I surely can save my family. And there's nothing more important. I can surely be an example to them. Is there anything in this world that's more important than that? I think not. Let's stand and sing.